Today is a day that I've been looking forward to for some time. And that's because that for more than 2 years now, a group of us has been meeting together to talk about what it would look like for Montclair Presbyterian Church to declare ourselves to be a peace church, a congregation that has made a formal self-identifying statement of pacifism. We undertook this project at the behest of our denomination, which has invited churches to consider making formal statements of peace. And so we met together, we wrote up a peace church declaration. We brought that declaration first to our social justice committee, and then we took the statement to our session, and now on this day, after our celebration, we're going to bring this statement to the congregation as a whole, and we will vote on whether or not we want finally to declare ourselves to be a peace church. We decided to make today the day to vote on the peace church statement because today is the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War, a war that was supposed to be a war to end all wars. In preparation for this long-awaited day, I made a plan to preach three sermons, one in August and one in September and one today. And each of these sermons would address a concern that folks have raised about pacifism in general or about our Peace Church Declaration in particular. So in August, I addressed the most frequently asked question that has come up. And that question is this: what about World War II? Wasn't it right for us to fight in World War II? And what I've said in response to that question was that this work of declaring ourselves to be a peace church, it's not meant to be an exercise in judging history. Those of us who worked on the peace church statement had different and nuanced opinions about World War II. What we did agree on, however, is that we need to prevent the next global war. And we agreed that pacifism is the way to do that. We say this because World War II only happened because the First World War tilled the soil and planted the seeds for the bitter fruit of Nazism. And World War II only happened because of the Franco-Prussian War, which only happened because of Napoleon's wars, which only happened because of the French Revolution and because the United States financed Napoleon by buying Louisiana from France so that we could wage war on and commit genocide against the native people living west of the Mississippi River. We believe war begets more war. So in our group, whatever we may or may not have thought about the necessity of World War II, we all agreed that the best way to keep such a horrible thing from happening again would be to figure out how to abstain from war altogether. Then in September, I addressed the issue of just war theory. That's an approach to evaluating the morality of war that the Presbyterian Church historically has used whenever questions of war arise. The good thing about the just war theory is that when it's applied properly, it makes just war impossible. Among other things, just war theory requires that no non-combatants be killed during a war, and that it also requires that violence employed must be proportional to violence suffered. These requirements make the just war theory impossible to follow in the modern world. The just war theory also requires that peace be the ultimate goal of any war, and as we have noted in this sermon already, there is no such thing as a war that ends all wars. Wars don't lead to peace. Wars either lead to complete destruction of an enemy, something that cannot be achieved without harming and killing civilians, or war ends by setting the stage for more war. Therefore, just war is an oxymoron. So what the committee decided in writing our statement is that we needed to employ new or at least additional ideas when calling for peace, because not many people are paying attention to the just war theories anymore. So we decided to make use of ideas embraced by the earliest Christians and by those Christians who we call Anabaptists, the folks like the Mennonites or the Brethren or the Amish. These are people who refuse to fight wars because wars are waged by governments, and governments are run by people, and people are fallible and cannot be trusted to make ethical and moral decisions at the place where power and violence intersect. So, as I was getting ready for today's sermon, I realized that I'm actually one sermon short in the project of preaching sermons that address the questions that have come up. Because as more of you have been reading the Peace Church Declaration, it became clear to me that there are two questions that I still need to address in today's one sermon. So I'm going to try to do them both. First, several of you have asked what declaring ourselves a peace church would say about our support for military intervention when waging war might actually prevent some other country from committing atrocities or from building empires. The other question folks are asking is this: what good will it do to declare ourselves a peace church? What does it accomplish? What is the plan for implementation? So, two questions. What about war to address crimes against humanity, and what good does it do? Those are the two questions. And so I'm going to start answering the first question by making reference to this morning's lesson from Mark. This is an important passage in the New Testament. Some version of this passage is found in all of the synoptic gospels, that is, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and many people consider this to be the most basic expression of Christian ethics and moral theory. This is the principle that must guide all Christian considerations of what is right and wrong. We are to love God, and we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And by the way, this ethical and moral principle is not original to Jesus. When Jesus tells us to love the Lord our God with all of our heart and mind and soul and strength and to love our neighbor as ourselves, he is actually quoting two laws from the Torah, part of what we Christians call the Old Testament. And he was not the first rabbi to summarize the law in this way. It is said that the great Rabbi Hillel, who was alive and active during the years when Jesus was a child, he once had someone say to him that he would become a more religious Jew if Hillel could recite the whole law while standing on one foot. And so Hillel stood on one foot and said, "Love your neighbor as yourself. The rest is all commentary." Christian ethics and morality, then, are rooted in a Jewish legal principle, which is this: your conduct towards others should reflect how you want others to treat you. In another place, Jesus said, "Do to others what you would have them do to you." This is the golden rule. And just about every religious tradition embraces some kind of version of this principle, which is to say, it is good guideline. It is a good guideline for making moral and ethical choices and statements. Incidentally, last week I made reference to this same principle when I mentioned the Old Testament's rules about immigration. "Remember to be kind to immigrants, to strangers," says the Torah. In several places it says this. And why? "Because you were immigrants, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Do to others what you would have them do to you." And that's actually a pretty good segue. That discussion of immigration is a good segue for addressing the question that some of you have asked about the Peace Church Declaration. What about waging war to prevent crimes against humanity? You know, we don't have to look back to Hitler after all. Atrocities happen all the time. And shouldn't we stop those atrocities militarily like we did in Kuwait and in the Balkans and what we didn't do but maybe should have done in Rwanda? Our peace declaration, I should note, does not envision isolationism. But it does recognize the fact that waging war is not the only or the best way to effect positive change. Diplomacy, economic sanctions, nonviolent peacekeeping interventions, these are all options, and they are better options. But even so, there was a time, not all that long ago, when I would not have called myself a pacifist, because I believed there was a time to wage war on behalf of those suffering grave and serious injustice at the hands of brutal dictators and psychopathic strongmen. I embraced Latin American-style liberation theology, which generally believes in the necessity of using violence in the context of violence to achieve justice for the oppressed. But here's what I realized. I thought it was a good idea to wage war to get justice for the oppressed, but I only ever envisioned such violence happening in other countries. The only scenario I could imagine is the United States military or some other band of sisters and brothers fighting a good fight overseas, probably in the developing world, perhaps against a country with a history of genocide, a country with a seriously disproportionate distribution of wealth, a country that committed human rights abuses, maybe, I don't know, separating children from their parents and imprisoning those children and losing the children in the system, a country that might mobilize its vast military resources to prevent, with live fire, migrants from crossing the border in search of asylum or jobs, a country ruled over by a madman who makes use of propaganda and who actively works to silence a free press, a leader who coddles white supremacists and anti-Semites, who uses fear and hatred to divide and conquer his people. That's the kind of country I thought it might be ethical and moral to attack in order to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe. Turns out I was asking the wrong question, right? If we are going to be faithful to the foundational principles of Christian ethics and moral philosophy, the question we need to ask, the question I need to ask, and you maybe need to ask this as well, the question is not, would it be ethical and moral for the United States military to intervene on behalf of those suffering in other countries? Because that's not the right question. Because I live in Montclair, two doors down from the church here, the first question I need to ask is this. Would it be moral and ethical for some other country to drop bombs on Montclair as a way of safeguarding the human rights of Central Americans seeking asylum in the United States? And you should probably ask the same question as well. Because the United States is kidnapping children, separating children from their parents, deporting the parents without their kids, and losing track of the children in the system. That is a heinous crime. Should a foreign military start dropping bombs in the neighborhood where you live to prevent this atrocity? That's the question we need to ask. And I'm not going to answer the question for you, but I know that I'm not ready for my neighbors, my children, myself, to die to atone for the sins of my government. When I think of my neighborhood being destroyed by bombs, things like diplomacy and economic pressure and nonviolent intervention, they start to seem really attractive to me. And I know that I'm not willing to have my neighborhood destroyed because Washington has become overrun by racism and xenophobia. And if I'm not willing for my neighborhood to be destroyed because of what's going on in Washington, then I cannot in good conscience support the idea that neighborhoods in other cities around the world should be punished in ways that I wouldn't want to have happen where I live. I wouldn't want my neighborhood to be destroyed, my loved ones to be killed because my government is vile. So I cannot support the same for other people. Again, I'm not arguing for isolationism. I'm suggesting that military violence is not a moral or ethical solution, and that when it comes to addressing violations of human rights or crimes against humanity, military violence is not the only option, and it certainly is not the best option. Because war only ever leads to more war, even when war is waged for righteous reasons. And usually, war is the underlying problem in the first place. Besides, I'll say it again, I would not be okay with some other country dropping bombs on Oakland in an effort to change American policies that I agree are immoral. It would therefore be an act of extreme hypocrisy for me to be okay with the United States dropping bombs on someone else's city, even when the motive for doing so might seem just. One cannot love one's neighbor with bombs. Nor, would I argue, can one love one's God with bombs. And that leads me to the other question. What good does it do to declare ourselves to be a peace church? Isn't it enough if we act like a peace church? And we certainly act like a peace church. Who's listening to our declarations anyway? And if ours is a peace church, do I have to be a pacifist to belong to this community? Let me deal with that last question first. This is Montclair Presbyterian Church. You don't have to agree with anything to belong to this community. Rest assured. But in answer to the question of what good will it do to declare ourselves to be a peace church, my answer to that question is that most human religious traditions are declarative. And by that, I mean that making declarations is an ancient and common way for people to express their internal spirituality. Making declarations is simply giving voice to what we believe on the inside, and that's an important act. It's an important spiritual act. In this morning's lesson, Jesus names as most important a law that every Jewish person is meant to declare regularly. The book of Deuteronomy says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Keep these words that I'm commanding you today in your heart. Recite them, declare them to your children, and talk about them, declare them when you are at home and when you are away and when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hands, fix them as an emblem on your forehead so you're declaring them without words, and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." When Jesus says what is the most important commandment, he recites a commandment that is meant to be declared regularly. It's not just Christianity and Judaism. In Islam, a person is meant to repeat the declaration, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the prophet of God." Muslims are meant to repeat that many times a day, day after day. In many Christian traditions, a person must recite the Apostles' Creed as a declaration before taking communion or being baptized. In the Presbyterian Church, we have confessions, we have declarations as part of our constitution. Declarations are meant to guide what we are and who we are. So when we make declarations, we are doing something basic to human spirituality. We are giving words to what we believe. And words certainly have power. I don't know where the words of our declaration will lead us. I like to think we might be inspired to integrate peacemaking into our educational programs and into our celebrations on a more regular basis. Heck, I like to think that someone will notice our declaration and will put us on some kind of list. I wish our voices were that loud. But there are practical results of our declaration as well. As we mentioned in the declaration, by declaring ourselves to be a peace church, we will be helping the children of our congregation, if they so choose, to claim conscientious objector status if they're ever called up in a draft. We also mention in the declaration that the Presbyterian Church USA has asked its member congregations to consider becoming peace churches as part of a larger conversation about peacemaking that's happening in our denomination. We are participating in that conversation, so there are very practical ways in which our declaration makes a difference. But even if declaring ourselves to be a peace church was something we were doing in isolation, declarations are, in themselves, by themselves, declarations are accomplishments because they give voice to what we believe. So I believe this is a worthwhile exercise, even if no one listens. In considering this morning's lesson from Mark, this directive that we should love God and love our neighbors as ourselves, the novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson has written that in the passage, there is a synthesis that is unique to theology, an acknowledgement that in sacred matters and in the theater of God's glory that we share with those strangers, our neighbors, love means awe, and awe means love. If that's a valid understanding of this basic rule for Christian ethics and morality, and I think it is, if awe and love are inseparable in Christian ethics and morality, then peacemaking must certainly lie at the very heart of what it means to be a person whose ethical and moral choices are an expression of healthy spirituality. For if we are loving our neighbors, then we cannot possibly harm our neighbors. even for what might seem like a good reason. And if we do harm our neighbors, we cannot claim to live lives molded by the beauty and wonder and joy of God. For if we are rejoicing in God, if we are allowing ourselves to be touched by God's infinite beauty and abiding peace, we cannot give expression to such awe with murderous destruction. This, dearly beloved, is a truth worth declaring. May we all live lives in which love and awe intersect, and may we live together in peace. Amen.